Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloh. Our guests are Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. They're the BBC filmmaking team behind the new Nova series, The Planets, which begins this week on PBS. Part of a partnership between PBS and the BBC, the UK version features Brian Cox as its presenter-host, while Nova uses actor Zachary Quinto, perhaps best known for his role as Spock in the reboot of the Star Trek movies as the American narrator. What both versions, British and American, feature are visuals that are both based on the latest scientific information from space probes such as Cassini and New Horizons, and they're also visually stunning. One of the reasons for this is the partnership between the filmmakers, scientists, and a company called Lola VFX that has produced visual effects for many Hollywood films, such as The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and Captain America, The First Adventure. We spoke with both of the filmmakers from their studio offices in London. My first question for you guys, I'll ask you, Gideon, this is... is this derivative at all of the Planet series that I used to watch from about, back around 2000, that was from BBC on A&E in America?
That's more than 20, almost 20 years now. Yes. No, it is, in the sense that the topic is the same, that we're going to take the audience out to the 8 bodies, one of which is us ourselves, and take them, try and take them in the most sort of immersive way that we're able. Of course, there's an awful lot of science that's happened. We've sent probes out to pretty much all the planets, save perhaps 2. We've revisited, so there's a lot more kind of science and excitement to share with the audience this time around. And I think also, you know, visual effects have come along a fair bit since then, it's fair to say. So, you know, we've put a lot of care and love and attention into, I guess, really getting people onto the surface of the planets, and really trying to sell a vision of what it would be like to really, you know, experience these things if you could get down to the surface, because you know, many of the probes have managed to do that now. That's I guess why this is such an exciting series to you know, bring to people 20 years later.
So I've been in the BBC Science Unit for 25 years now. And so I was around when that series, The Planets, was made. I think one of the great things about kind of being in a production entity like the BBC Science Unit is that, you know, these opportunities to make a big series about the planets only come around every 10 years or so. And so when they come around, you know, you have to do something unusual, something original, and something that does kind of, you know, look back to kind of what we've done in the past, but to find a new way of doing it. And that's been really one of the pleasures of making this series.
Well, I've watched most of it, and very, very excited by it. It's beautiful. I have one small complaint.
Go for it.
There's two different versions of this. There's the BBC version and the one for America. And as I recall, of the one back around 2000, like Candace Bergen was one of the narrators for the one we saw in America. And on this one, we have Zachary Quinto, who, of course, played Spock in the new Star Trek movies. I would have personally loved to have seen Brian Cox. And I'm wondering what's behind the decision to go with an American narrator rather than Brian Cox as your presenter here in America. Do you, any comments on that?
I think, you know, that when we make these series, they're often tailored to particular kind of parts of the world. And I think every time we make a series like this, you know, sometimes the UK presenter appears in certain regions where it's broadcast. Other times there's a different voice that appears. So it's one of those sort of kind of decisions that sort of gets made region by region. So we love working with Brian. We're also really proud of the way that Zachary's voice has worked on the series. So, but I'm glad you like both.
Yeah, no complaints about Zachary. He's wonderful, and love him. I'm a huge Brian Cox fan. So I think what I need to do is I'm going to buy the DVDs from BBC so I can have Brian.
They kind of bring you know, different things to the table. It's quite interesting because you know, Brian is a kind of a host, you know, very, very brilliant at what he does. You know, over the years, he's become completely expert in, you know, the planets, the story of the planets and the physics behind that. But what's interesting in the US version is that we've been able to bring in, you know, all the mission scientists who actually flew these missions and give them more screen time. So even though narratively we're telling the same story in both versions, you get these kind of very different experiences, which is, you know, making them both. I think we're all sort of equally proud of both versions, actually. They kind of do just a very slightly different thing.
Long history of this, though. You know, the big natural history series that the BBC has made over the years, you know, that have David Attenborough voicing them in the UK and in many parts of the world, often were revoiced in the US. So maybe it's a British thing, I don't know, but it's happened quite a lot over the years.
Personally, it was great to meet Spock. I've worked with Brian before, but it's great to meet Spock.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, I shouldn't say it's a complaint. It's kind of a win-win. You could have both.
Great.
All right, well, let's talk about the series. One of my favorite things about this is the look of it, because it's so dramatic and stunning. And it's not just a matter of it's beautiful to look at and it's got great... you can explain what they are, the computer animation effects that you do. It's that as I watch it, as a bona fide expert in my own right on planetary science, when I look at each of these episodes, I'm recognizing these are directly taken from the imagery coming from the spacecraft, from Cassini, from Voyager. Like one of my favorite scenes is when you're showing Neptune and the cloud decks on Neptune, those streaming white clouds. I recognize that as imagery from the Voyager spacecraft, but produced in this dramatic way that just blew my mind. Can you tell us about how you went about doing that?
A lot of the secret sauce there is that we work with a fantastic visual effects company over here in London called Lola. And what's interesting about them is that they've done quite a few of these series in the past as well. I've always wanted to work with them for years and never quite managed to kind of align. And they kind of went off and did some other stuff and have been doing lots of drama recently. And then this gig came along and we kind of joined forces. And it's just one of those really sort of great things where they had the tools and, the, you know, the visual effects industry is always moving along as computation gets faster and, you know, the software gets smarter about how you do all this stuff. And yeah, we were able to apply all of that to, as you say, all this amazing source material that there is now just so much beautiful, real, often two-dimensional, you know, photographs or little sequences of video that we get back from the probes. You know, and I'm sure you're aware there's a whole host of people out there that are processing these shots now in their bedrooms. There's so much data coming back that NASA can't deal with it all. So it's just so inspirational to see all of that stuff. What we were able to do is to kind of just move it on a little bit and start taking that into a 3D software and then starting to be a little bit creative with it, just starting to imagine where we could put cameras to hopefully give people exactly as you say, you know, that ability. You've seen the shot, that shot from Voyager from above. So what would it be like to be actually down in those clouds, you know, just slowly traveling over that planet? How would that feel?
You know, when we started making this series, we wanted to set about making a series that really visualizes, you know, 4.5 billion years of history. And it was amazing how few moments in the solar system's history, even though we'd sent, you know, all of these probes have gone out to really understand kind of that life story, how few moments had actually been visualized before in any way whatsoever. And so that it was an amazing Pandora's box to be able to say, well, we want to see the birth of Saturn's rings, or we want to experience what it was like when Jupiter kind of went on this extraordinary journey into the inner solar system beyond the asteroid belt. And there was a sort of, this was just new territory for anyone to visualize, which is an amazing space to be when you're making a series like this.
Well, one of the things that really occurred to me watching it was, of course, having Zachary as your narrator made me think of Star Trek and the reboot in the first movie when they show the Enterprise hiding in Titan's cloud layer and using that imagery from the Cassini spacecraft. You know, they kind of use that. So in that sense, you know, the planets are this dramatic backdrop for the characters and the story in the Star Trek movie. But in your series, it's the planets that are the story. They are the stars. And I love that about this.
That was something that kind of Gideon and I and the rest of the team, you know, really kind of talked about very early on in the series. It's the idea that this was a, you know, a family drama. And one of the sort of things that we hope comes through in the series is the fact that, you know, the solar system is a family. Every planet is interconnected to every other one in often surprising ways. So it was really important that we started to treat them as individual characters, that we started to look at their life stories across, you know, both the past, the present and the future. And looked at the way that they sort of intertwined in their stories as well, so that that sort of drama really could play out in terms of seeing sort of, you know, the success and failures across each of the individual characters.
Well, I'm interested to ask you something. Do you have a favorite planet, or did you have a favorite planet going in? And after the series, did that change, or do you have one now? I know that's like asking you what's your favorite kid or whatever, but do you have a favorite planet?
I can jump in there. I mean, in terms of one that changed, we're coming into this, the one that I was most kind of fearful of, you know, in terms of that kind of narrative story that Andrew was talking about, was definitely Mercury. You know, poor old Mercury, closest to the sun, the tiniest, pretty much looking like a moon. I didn't know an awful lot about the latest planetary science around Mercury coming into it. So I was thinking, gosh, how on earth are we going to get a story out of that? I mean, that thing just sits there being, you know, burnt to death slowly.
And it looks a lot like the moon.
Exactly. There's not an awful lot, you know, how do you even make it look different to the moon? You know, all of that kind of was a real kind of worry coming into it. You know, then we started just talking to people, you know, all these planetary scientists, and one of our academic consultants on the series is actually, you know, huge Mercury expert, and started telling us about this theory that Mercury may not have been born in the place that it resides today. And then, you know, as a storyteller, you start going, oh, that's interesting. You know, so what happened? Why did it grow up there? And how on earth has it ended up where it has? So for me, that would be my new favorite, because Mercury turns out to be really exciting. I think, you know, in terms of coming into it, it's got to be Saturn. You know, if you've ever looked through even binoculars or a telescope, you know, the first time you point it towards Saturn and see with your own eye another heavenly body like that when it's presenting with its rings, that experience is just extraordinary. So, you know, I did that quite late in life, actually. I suppose it was, I was in my sort of mid-20s when my wife bought me a telescope, and, you know, that stays with you, that kind of stuff. So I think Saturn coming into it, and she's still lovely, Saturn.
So mine didn't change through the production. I've always felt that Saturn is just the sort of because of what you can see here from Earth, it's always the most extraordinary. But the thing that really changed for me through the making of the series was my understanding of the asteroid belt. And Ceres is just extraordinary. This sort of this dwarf, this minor planet that tells you it's like this remnant from the formation of the terrestrial planets that sort of gives us a glimpse, a ghostly glimpse of sort of our past that's still sort of in some weird way geologically active as well. I was kind of blown away. That appears in the Jupiter episode. Is just an amazing sort of thing that I learned about a new world rather than a new planet.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the new BBC PBS Nova series, The Planets, with the producers, Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. We'll be right back. And we're back. Let's continue now with Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. They're the British filmmakers behind the new BBC PBS series The Planets that airs starting this week on Nova. Yeah, let's talk about Jupiter a bit, because it plays such an important role, not only in your series, but in the solar system, and you do such a good job of that. You use some of the latest findings and some of the ideas about the orbital dynamics of how it's actually kind of moved around in the solar system and had such an impact on all of the other planets.
Yeah, I mean, we called it the Godfather in it. In a sense, that really is what it is. It is the planet that has had the biggest influence on the formation of our solar system. And I think one of the interesting things, again, that I learned through the making is, you know, it's only in the last sort of decade or so that we've been able to look at other solar systems. We assumed up until now that our solar system was kind of, you know, the standard, that this is what you had. You had kind of, you know, rocky planets kind of on the inside and sort of kind of gas giants on the outside, and that's what it was. And it's really interesting learning about Jupiter's story, but also understanding that what's happened here for us is incredibly rare compared to other star systems. And that's something that I've really enjoyed understanding through the making of the series.
Yeah, one of the things that comes across in your series that it makes me really happy is that, you know, as I was growing up and studying the solar system, we always had the notion that, oh, you know, there are probably other solar systems around, other stars, other planetary systems, and they probably look a lot like, you know, our solar system, with small rocky worlds huddled close to the star and then the gas giants farther out. And it turns out that our solar system's weird.
Yeah, the ego was wrong. that's right. Yeah, and you know, maybe Jupiter played a big role in that, as you know, as you'll discover in the series, and as you know, all that new science that you're talking about, this grand tack theory that Jupiter becomes the great kind of organizer of our solar system, you know, and therefore how connected we all are to the story of Jupiter. I mean, that's another thing that I think, you know, the filmmaking team on that particular episode really, really hit home, is that, you know, you might think that it's this distant thing that you see remotely off in a, you know, on a cold, dark night, but actually, we may not be here without it. And even, you know, today it may well be playing an effect on our, or may have an effect on our sort of future. And that's that was a really lovely thing to sort of draw out in that film.
It also changes the way that you sort of see the science. When you suddenly realize that the solar system is, you know, effectively a crime scene of Jupiter's sort of, you know, violence, and that, you know, what we're actually doing kind of with all of these probes that we're sending out, with all of the kind of this kind of exploration that we're doing is understanding this 4.5 billion year old crime scene. I suddenly saw, it's amazing when you see something in a completely different way. Like when you look at the mission objectives of all of, you know, most of the NASA missions, it's often to explore the history of the planetary system. And yet that story hadn't really been told. That was one of the pleasures of this series, that we got to use the latest data, but to share with audiences the idea that we've been writing this story. And for the first time, it's all starting to fit together. We don't understand it all, but we're actually starting to understand how all the different bits across this extraordinary amount of time have conspired to create, effectively, you know, our planet, the one living planet in the solar system.
And to loop back, David, to your earlier question, you know, that's one of the things, we just couldn't have told these stories, you know, 20 years ago on that original series, because a lot of this stuff, we just didn't know it. So, you know, it's a very contemporary snapshot of the latest state of the art understanding, really, of the planets around us.
Yes, you've really taken advantage of what I like to call the golden age of planetary science, which has been, you know, really, you know, if you look at it since about 1979 to now, is because, you know, we're celebrating, you know, the 50th anniversary of Project Apollo. But one of what Carl Sagan called the gifts of Apollo in his book, The Pale Blue Dot, is that that a lot of that money went to the Voyager projects, went to Cassini and these large robotic explorations. And we're still, you know, we're reaping the benefit of the harvest of all of that information. And then, of course, the New Horizons mission going by Pluto. And now you have Juno at Jupiter. This is just an incredible era of planetary science. And you've been able to, you know, reap the benefits of that in this series.
And hopefully share the excitement. You know, what you see with that direct connection with the mission scientists is just, you know, imagine those people that have worked on that Cassini mission. It's like a whole career, a whole lifetime, keeping that spacecraft alive and processing the data. And you know, I think that's palpable in that particular episode, the Saturn episode, where you just see them coming to terms with what an extraordinary thing that was, and what an opportunity that was, and how much it's taught us.
Yeah, that's amazing. And let's talk about some of the scientists that you have, you have such a great team of scientists. Like for example, Linda Spilker from Cassini, and you know, just she's such an amazing person. Can you tell us a bit about you can't name them all, but some of the scientists that really stood out to you?
I think, well, Linda, I mean, to be honest, the entire Cassini team. But what was really interesting is that whole cohort of scientists, we filmed them around about sort of 8 months after that. And I don't think most of them hadn't really thought about the mission too much in that kind of reflective way since then, certainly not on camera. And so we caught them at this really interesting stage in their lives, really, where they'd had time to process what that really meant. And Linda, particularly, I mean, she weeps in the program towards the end. She's so kind of overcome by I'm speaking for her here. I don't know exactly what was going through her mind, but I guess it would be a huge sense of pride and just this joy of working with all these other brilliant people on this amazing project. So, Linda was extraordinary. Carolyn was amazing and incredibly generous again to give her, you know, a time and participate in the film. I mean, she was there from Voyager, obviously, before that as well. You know, she worked on that mission and then on to Cassini. Michelle Doherty too. You know, all these people that work together to keep that little spacecraft alive and then working through all the data it was sending back.
I think one of the things that is sort of overt in the series and that we made a decision about really early on is that we didn't want people commenting on the science. We wanted people who had experienced the science. So pretty much everyone that appears in the series has had a tangible connection to one of these sort of extraordinary missions that's been sent out. And what you get from that is a different relationship between, you know, if you've been involved in building this thing or receiving the data or working with the data, then your connection with the sort of the exploration, you know, we often talked about the fact that sort of imagining that these people had dreamt of being on these planets or on these moons. They'd really been there because they're the ones that had sent the probes out. And that was a really important sort of filter that we put through the series.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say there is one omission, of course, which if you've been being attentive, you may have noticed that, of course, when we went to Venus and actually got probes down onto the surface of Venus, that was, you know, obviously a team of Russian scientists.
Yes.
And early on in the production, we were in touch with Roscosmos and we were pushing really hard to try and go and meet some of the people that worked on that mission as well, because you know, that is the only time that we've been down to the surface to this date. And sadly, at the time, you may be aware of this or maybe not, but there were some incidents in the UK which made it very tense suddenly. So we found it very hard to actually, you know, get out to Russia and conduct those interviews. But we were all set to go when things became, you know, quite bleak diplomatically, which is a real shame because, you know, it would have been lovely to have heard that testimony as well firsthand.
Yeah, that it's a little unfortunate, but the episode on where you talk about Venus and the other inner planets it's fascinating to think about what Venus was like early on, and Mars for that matter, to what it is now. Because now, boy, if there was ever a cautionary tale, Venus is it.
Yeah, and you just have to tell the story, right? You know, you don't really need the polemic. It's all there that atmospheres can change, and that can have, you know, pretty serious results, I guess, for, you know, the planet itself. And
talk about, you know, global warming gone crazy, that, you know, temperatures there are 900 degrees Fahrenheit and the pressures are like being under 1,000 feet of water. Oh, before we move on, I have to say one of my favorite parts of the series was, I think it was in the Icy Worlds episode, is you do one of the most classic demonstrations that's been done a bazillion time. I do it every year with my earth science classes, where we make a scale model of the solar system. But you do it with David Grinspoon, and it's just fabulous. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. The way that the series was kind of constructed, you may not sort of realize this watching it, but we would shoot a lot of the visual effects. We would actually be shooting real locations on Earth quite a bit. So in that particular episode, the team were in Iceland and they were filming textures that were kind of then subsequently manipulated to create planetary surfaces for Pluto, for example. So they'd be elements within some of those shots that give you a feeling of what it would be like to be on the surface of Pluto all the way out there. So we had the unit out in Iceland, and David joined us there, as you just outlined, to sort of try and help us tell the show and make people feel just how far away Pluto is. So the team were kind of looking around Iceland trying to figure out, well, where could we do that? How could we do that? What would be a good way to get that across? And the director on that series, a guy called Martin Johnson, found this extraordinary light that is actually a memorial to John Lennon, believe it or not. It's called the Peace Light. And it sits out there in the bay. It's on a tiny little island out in the bay from Reykjavik. So when we found that, we thought, oh, wow, there's this light that's visible for miles around. It's a light source. Hey, that could be our sun. So we kind of did the math then. You know, you figured out how big the light was, and then we started working out the distances. So absolutely to scale, so that, you know, I forget exactly how wide that light was now, maybe 5-10 meters. You know, if that's the diameter of the sun, how far away is Mercury? And that turns out to be, you know, a good few meters away, as you see in the sequence. And then as you go further and further out into the solar system, you know, you have to cross the harbor back into Reykjavik before you get to Jupiter and its realm, leaving all of the rocky planets back on that tiny little island across the bay. And on you go further and further away until, I think in the end it was around about, you're talking kilometers, like 8 or 9 kilometers away on our scale, before you get the opportunity to look back and see that distant light, you know, across the twinkling lights of Reykjavik. So that was fun to kind of figure out, you know, and when you start realizing, gosh, that really is quite a long way and we're going to need a car to get him out there and, you know, all of that, it just felt like, well, that's a really intriguing way to try and help people really understand the distances involved.
Well, like I said, it's a classic demonstration. It's been done many times, but your visual presentation of it is just like, it blew my mind. I was like, oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Good. Hopefully it'll be used in schools for years to come.
I'd like to do a little teaser bit for each of the episodes, because we don't want to talk about everything that's in them. We need you, gentle listener, to watch them, because they're way cool. But I'd like you to give us maybe a couple of, you know, what are some of the things that you thought were the most cool in each episode for each of you. So let's start with number one, The Inner Worlds, which covers the terrestrial planets, except for Mars, kind of. You're talking about Mercury, Venus, and Earth mostly in that episode.
So I think the story of Mercury in that episode is one that very few people have heard. The idea that Mercury has this hidden history, and that, you know, the could have beens with Mercury. We think of it as this scorched planet, but it could have gone down such a very, very different path is the really tantalizing thing about that particular film.
And there's a little cameo at the end, as you may know as well. It's worth tuning in for that. That film is not only the four rocky worlds, but it also is the only episode that kind of looks to the future of the solar system a little bit. And so, there's a little cameo at the end where we think about, consider if when the sun hits its old age and becomes this, swells to become this red giant star, what hope for rocky worlds at that stage? And we offer one vision of what might happen in that particular episode.
It's also the one that I think has the most sort of profound impact in terms of our own planet and understanding the sort of the transitory nature. You know, we think about the kind of, you know, the Goldilocks kind of zone as something that, oh, we're lucky that we ended up here. But when you add time into that and realize that, you know, Goldilocks moves around, you start to look at the time that we find ourselves in on our own planet in a slightly different way, which I find sort of is a really affecting and profound sort of realization.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the next episode, which deals with a planet that we've spent a lot of effort in exploring, especially recently with the Mars rovers, the Spirit and Opportunity. And you have a great guest there in Steve Squires and Ashwin Vasavada from JPL and Curiosity rover and the orbiters, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Mars is just such an amazingly interesting place.
And has been throughout its history. I mean, I think the one thing that sort of kind of sticks in my mind when I think about that particular film is the idea that, you know, we know the surface of Mars in such detail that we can realize this water world, this place that looks so familiar, but not just familiar. You know, there was a moment in Mars's history where everything seemed to be in place for life to begin. You know, every ingredient that we understand was needed for life to start on Earth seems to have been in place on Mars. And so that just tantalizing question of whether, you know, did it? And if it did, what happened to life? I think is something that sort of just drives through that film in a way that feels like kind of one of the great mysteries of science.
Anything you want to add to that?
I would add one little thing. That if you're a fan of waterfalls,
yes,
then it's definitely worth tuning into the Mars episode because there's some great evidence that Mars was once home to one of the most spectacular falls in the solar system, which is it was a terrific thing to discover. And the other thing is that I'd never really appreciated before is that, you know, that Mars went through these sort of massive geological epochs as well, that when this stuff was around, you know, frozen, cold Mars as well, it's not just warm, wet, you know, it went through these massive changes on the way to being the, you know, the dry, dusty, cold red planet that we see today.
I love how you call Jupiter the godfather. It just makes me think of, you know, all of these things and thinking about Mars. It's like, Sorry, Mars, we're going to have to let Earth have life, so you got to lose your magnetic field. That's the way it goes.
If only the voiceover had been like that, I think it would have been a better film.
I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. They're the filmmakers behind the new series, The Planets, which airs on the iconic Nova program from PBS. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's finish up our conversation with Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. Their new series, The Planets, was produced by the BBC in partnership with PBS and features state-of-the-art science coupled with major Hollywood studio-quality visual effects to produce a stunning cinematic tour of our solar system. Well, tell us about Jupiter, because if you, when you talk about visually spectacular, there is no more visually spectacular planet. You know, Saturn is pretty, it's beautiful, but Jupiter visually looks like, you know, when you show people images of Jupiter, a lot of time they think, well, that's not real, is it? But yes, it is.
Well, particularly since Juno. I mean, Juno has blown apart our, you know, people still don't recognize the imagery that's coming back from Juno as being Jupiter, do they? You look at it and you think, where on Earth is that?
Yeah.
Just because the coloration is so extraordinary and the, you know, it's kind of to see the poles of Jupiter has just kind of blown apart our sort of that fixed sense of what it looks like. I love the fact that Jupiter was lurking there before the sun fully lit was one of the things that we sort of illustrate in the series. And this idea that this kind of incredible force is sort of almost as old as the solar system itself and was the giant was lurking there, the monster was lurking there in the darkness was something that I enjoyed a lot about that film.
And I think we touched on that a little earlier, but, you know, that idea that without Jupiter there lurking, bossing things around and maybe just being a slightly benevolent and maybe slightly favorable towards Earth has played a big part in our story. You know, that comes through really strongly in the film as well, which is quite a surprise making it, I think, just realizing how important that connection was.
Well, it plays such a tremendous role in directing and redirecting objects like the asteroids and, you know, probably played a major role in the impact of the asteroid that took out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And one of my favorite moments of space science history was the Shoemaker Levy 9 impacts when the comet hit Jupiter and kind of showed us that, yes, impacts are a still ongoing process in the solar system. And this is just a hint of what went on way back, you know, millions and billions of years ago.
And that's one of my favorite musical moments in the entire series, actually. I think the score over the visual effects, when we render that, you know, try and again relive that moment when those bolides did just plow into that extraordinary, you know, atmosphere that we've been talking about. The musicians did such a clever thing there, which I every time I watch it, I just sit there with a smile on my face.
Yeah, we haven't really said anything about it. I should. The music in this is just adds to the drama of it. And, you know, there's the old saying that in space, no one can hear you scream and there's no sound in space, but you got to have music. Like, you know, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, what really made that movie for me was the music soundtrack. And this film, your films, have the same kind of effect with just great dramatic scoring. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, those references are great references. And, you know, at the beginning, at the outset, we were very keen to sort of draw on that rich heritage of sci-fi, but with a very sort of modern contemporary twist. So we ended up working with a company called Bleeding Fingers in Santa Monica. And they're a group of composers that work alongside Hans Zimmer at his studio. And obviously, Hans had just come off the back end of Blade Runner, the movie. And if you've seen that movie, you know, it's got this very characteristic synth tones through it that feel epic and expansive. So that was one of the references that we used coming into this. And there are definitely cues in there that hopefully, you know, make you think a little bit about that movie and others. In fact, one review did pick that up over in the UK, which was, you know, Andrew and I were very pleased to see. But yeah, so they were really great collaborators, and we'd work remotely. You know, they weren't in the UK, so we would send over cuts, and then they would respond to that artistically, and then we'd sort of talk about what they'd done. And quite often, that's that lovely thing in filmmaking where a cue that they score for a particular scene doesn't actually work for us at this end, but does find its place somewhere else in the series. So yeah, it was just a really joyful part of the series, actually, scoring it. It's great fun.
Well, we're getting a little tight on time, but let's move on. And I want to, let's be as concise as we can, but still hit some of the good stuff. Let's talk about the penultimate episode, Saturn, which we already mentioned is such a beautiful planet. But one of the things I found most interesting was like your take on some of the moons of Saturn.
So, my favorite part of that film is the destruction of the moon, actually. I think possibly my favorite sequence in the whole series is seeing the kind of what feels almost like a kind of mythology play out, where you understand perhaps for the first time how the rings of Saturn were created. And it's that combination of extraordinary violence and power combined with beauty, I think, that we know is lurking when we look up at Saturn now. So for me, it's actually, as much as the moons that we've explored recently are extraordinary, it's the destruction of a moon that I enjoy most in that film.
Yeah, and that's relatively new science too.
Yeah, and still a little contentious around sort of exactly, kind of when that happened. We know the rings are young, but kind of actually understanding kind of when that event may have occurred is a difficult one to put a finger on.
Yeah, there's a great moment where I think Carolyn Porco says something to the effect that if a velociraptor during the age of the dinosaurs was looking through his telescope at Saturn, no rings.
Right. In the kind of Saturn production period, we were lucky that there was some more Cassini data that they'd been looking at and realized you get this thing called ring rain. You know, you get some of some of the ice is actually falling in towards the planet. And if that's happening, there's obviously not another moon replenishing it. So eventually those rings are going to disappear. So we were able to just about sneak that into the program, because that literally came in as we were in the last few months of production. So not only are they young, but they're not going to be there forever.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard to pick a favorite episode, I'm sure it would be for you, but I love the final episode, The Ice Worlds, because it features one of my close friends, Alan Stern. And, you know, what we saw when New Horizons flew by in several hours, when it flew by Pluto for the very first time in July of 2015, the renderings that you do of that and what Pluto really looks like with that giant mountain range that's like 20,000 feet high and the strange icy plains, that is just gorgeous.
It's still a surprise to everyone, isn't it? I mean, it's still that the discovery that it is this active, dynamic, geological surface all the way out there. I think everyone is still processing that idea. You know, it's hard to believe, and it's what makes kind of all of that science so exciting.
And it's active. You know, that was the other thing, yeah. Is that, you know, it's not just this frozen kind of, you know, tiny little world hanging on there right at the edge. It is actually active. There's geology.
Well, for a planetary scientist, when we look at the surface of a moon or a planet that has a solid surface, you know, the first thing we look at are craters. And the fact that there were no craters on the Tombaugh Regio there, that the heart-shaped area, that was smooth, was just, you know, like, oh my gosh, how could this be out there in the Kuiper Belt where there's got to be debris flying around all the time and impacts? How could this thing be smooth like this? That blew the scientists away.
And it's a gift for a storyteller, because it's like, there's your hook right there. Yeah. You know, there's a mystery.
There's also just the plain fact that people still get very emotive and, you know, around the whole idea of whether Pluto should or shouldn't be a planet. It's just one of those funny things that everyone seems to have a view and an opinion on. And I think what I hope we deliver in this film that covers Pluto is that doesn't really matter ultimately whether it's a planet or a dwarf planet. It is an extraordinary world. So I hope somehow we've perhaps moved the conversation on around kind of people's disappointment that it's no longer considered a planet.
Hey, David, yeah, you put us on the spot earlier about our favorite planet. So can we ask you, is Pluto a planet?
Sure. Since Alan's a good friend of mine, he'd kill me if I said otherwise, but I agree with him. It's a planet. And here's why. This ties right back to the beginning of the show with Zachary Quinto, who's the science officer for the Enterprise. When you give it the Star Trek test, you look at the view screen and you see what's before you, you see a planet. You can imagine Spock saying, you know, this is a class M5 planet, blah, 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 with a nitrogen atmosphere, whatever he would say. It just looks like a planet. It's a fascinating place. It's got moons. It's a planet. It's a small planet, but the bottom line is, and you just alluded to this, of all of the places in the solar system, it's one of the most interesting. And, you know, whether you're talking about one of the moons of the outer planets, you know, like Io or Europa around Jupiter, or Titan around Saturn, or Enceladus, where, you know, those places that may harbor life in their oceans, it doesn't matter whether they're a planet or not. How interesting are they? And Pluto turned out to be one of the most interesting places in the solar system at all. So you got to save the best for last.
Completely agree, personally.
How X that is.
Well, Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen, producers for the new Nova series from BBC The Planets, thank you for joining us on Blue Dot.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much, David. Bye-bye.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to our guests, BBC filmmakers Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. You can catch their new series, The Planets, on Nova Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. on your local PBS affiliate and streaming for a limited time via the PBS.org website. Now it's time for an installment in Blue Dot's Teachable Moment series, where from time to time, we take a question you may have often wondered about, find out what you think, and then try our best to give you a reasonably accurate explanation. Here's our Teachable Moment questionnaire extraordinaire, Matt Fidler.
This is the Teachable Moment with Dave Shlohm, where we get answers to those burning scientific questions that sometimes linger in the back of our heads. I'm Matt Fidler. How's it going, Dave?
Good, Matt. What fascinating question did you pose this week?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, when I go camping in the woods and I stare up at the stars at night, how many stars am I actually seeing up there?
Ah, yeah. How many stars can you see at night when you go out under a dark night sky?
Right. Like, these numbers can be so huge.
Did you ask folks out on the street around Chico?
Of course I did, and here's what they said.
I don't know. Can I Google it?
You can't even count them. There's way too many.
I don't know. It depends upon your vision, right?
I'm thinking 100,000.
Because if you have like 2040 or 2050 vision, you might not see that many. You might only see one.
If I had to put a number on it, I would say at least 50,000.
2 million.
Probably like 100,000. Easy.
A couple mil, I'm thinking.
Thousands?
Million and a half.
Can I do my best Carl Sagan and say billions and billions? I would say 10,000.
60 billion-ish? I don't know. I've never tried to count them. When I was a kid, I was told, don't do that.
So is it a bad idea to try to count the stars in the sky?
Not if you're trying to keep your kids out of trouble, no.
So does it matter how good your vision is? Like that one person said,
Well, sure. Sure, but we're just talking about an average human being. And one of your respondents was the one who was a Carl Sagan fan. She had it right when she responded about 10,000, because that's about right. 10,000 stars can be seen from the Earth with the naked eye, with just your warm, moist eyeballs. But that's, you know, looking in all directions. So, you know, at any given time, looking at your half from your hemisphere, you're going to see about 5,000 to 6,000 stars.
Why does it seem like so much more?
Well, a lot of it's just perception, and people, you know, they know the universe is vast, and they've seen pictures, you know, with star-studded skies where cameras can collect more light. And so, you know, they know there are billions of stars out there, but when they look at a night sky, they just assume there's that many, but there really aren't. You know, in fact, you know, from a place like Chico, you know, you'd be lucky to see a couple hundred stars. From San Francisco, you might see 20. You're only going to see the brightest stars in the sky. So I always find it a lot of fun when you see somebody as a city dweller get up to the Dark Sky Festival at Lassen Volcanic National Park in August and see the Milky Way for the first time and really see a starry sky with thousands of stars.
So now, how do you come to that number of, what was it?
The human eye can detect stars down to sixth magnitude, which is like how we rate brightness of stars. The brightest stars in the sky are like magnitude one. The really bright things like planets have negative magnitudes. You can see down to magnitude six. There are about 10,000 stars that are magnitude six. We've cataloged them. A woman named Annie Jump Cannon, around the turn of the century, a hero of astronomers, she actually cataloged 350,000 stars herself. But only the stars that are bright enough to sixth magnitude under a really dark sky, you're only going to see, you know, a few thousand.
Well, thank you for that. And if you have a question out there that you'd like to ask Dave, give us a call and leave a voicemail. You can call 551 Blue Dot, and you may hear your question on a future episode. Dave Shlom is a science educator and host of Blue Dot, the science show about life here on Earth. You can find the podcast at mynspr.org or wherever you get your podcast. Both The Teachable Moment and Blue Dot are co-productions of North State Public Radio, reminding you that we all are living on a pale blue dot.
Thanks once again to our guests, BBC filmmakers Gideon Bradshaw and Andrew Cohen. Catch their new series, The Planets, on PBS's Nova. If I were to review it, I'd give it 4 out of 4 blue dots. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcasts on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.